You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 2nd of July 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll set the day's agenda with Dr. James Boyes from King's College London with the three stories you need to know. James, what have you got for us?
Well, this morning we've got Ed Snowden, a man without a country, Egypt, a nation without any unity, and Barack Obama, a president lacking an agenda.
Also ahead, election season gets underway in Chile, and there's already a frontrunner in the race to be president, the country's former leader, Michelle Bachelet. We're in Santiago to find out if she's unstoppable.
She got so many votes just from the left-wing side that she actually got not only a majority among the four candidates on her side, but also a majority even including the two candidates on the right-wing side. I mean, she just demolished all other comers.
Also coming up on the show...
These mountainous impasses were once traversed by the Romans. Now U.S. troops, conditioned for this terrain, ever cautious of their footing...
The liberation of the Italian city of Florence there during the closing stages of the Second World War. Later we're going to speak to the author whose new book uncovers how Italy's art treasures were saved by American troops amid the carnage of war-torn Europe.
And we'll head to the second annual Beirut Design Week and ask how the design industry is faring in Lebanon.
In terms of product design and furniture design, most of the Lebanese people, they just import their furniture from famous designers abroad. Then again, there are a handful of designers who don't really have a lot of choices.
All of that, plus we might even play some music too. That is all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a busy 60 minutes coming up ahead here on Midori House. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the latest world news.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. WikiLeaks says the US surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden has applied to 21 countries for asylum, including Ecuador, Norway and Russia. Snowden has spent over a week in the transit area of Moscow's Sheremetyevo Airport. WikiLeaks has released a statement from him in which he accuses the Obama administration of denying him his right to seek asylum. In an interview with the British newspaper The Guardian, which was the first to publish his allegations about secret surveillance, Snowden explained why he decided to reveal what he'd seen while working as a security contractor.
When you see everything, you see them on a more frequent basis, and you recognize that some of these things are actually abuses. And when you talk to people about them in a place like this, where this is the normal state of business, people tend not to take them very seriously and, you know, move on from them.
The European Union says it expects a full explanation from the United States on the allegations that it's been spying on its allies. President Obama has dismissed the row, saying that if he wants to know what the leaders of France, Germany or Britain are thinking, he calls them. And Claude Moniquet, a spy for France for 20 years, isn't surprised by the claims.
It's normal that the US want to know about this. And I think that in the other way, I'm quite sure that some European countries, certainly Germany and France, for instance, and certainly France, are spying the United States when they can.
Egypt's official news agency says the country's foreign minister, Mohamed Kamel Amer, has tendered his resignation. At least five other ministers have resigned in the wake of the protests against Mohamed Morsi's government. The army has issued an ultimatum, saying it'll give the president 48 hours to resolve the current situation, but it's denying that the ultimatum amounts to a military coup. Mr. Morsi has responded by saying that he hasn't been consulted by the army and will choose his own path. Amir Moussa, a former presidential candidate, says all sides must work together to find a solution.
Now there is a window of opportunity has been opened by the army. And under its aegis, we need to do that. We need to use all our political forces and our logic to try to get Egypt out of this very, very serious situation.
The Taliban says it carried out an attack which killed six people at a foreign logistics company in the Afghan capital, Kabul. The local police chief says two lorry drivers and four guards were killed after a suicide bomber drove a truck loaded with explosives into a vehicle bay in a compound near Kabul Airport. At least two attackers were then killed in a brief gunfight. Two suicide vests packed with explosives have been recovered from the scene. Israel has launched a crackdown against Jewish ultranationalists in the West Bank. They're accused of deliberately vandalizing Palestinian property to try to worsen sectarian tensions. Israeli officials say their actions are tantamount to terrorism. An unmanned Russian rocket has crashed seconds after blasting off from a cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. The Proton M rocket was carrying three satellites for Russia's global navigation system. The Interfax news agency is warning that the crash site may have been infected by 500 tons of poisonous fuel from the rocket. No injuries have been reported. A similar rocket crashed shortly after being launched 6 years ago. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. We'll see Barney in just under 25 minutes from now. It is 5 minutes past 8 o'clock in the morning here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
So this is Midori House. We are live from Studio One in London, and we are going to set the day's agenda now. Dr. James Boyes is with us. He's Senior Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London, and he joins us here in the studio. James, welcome back to the programme. Nice to have you with us.
Good morning. Always good to be here, chaps.
And we will start with Edward Snowden taking hold of the argument that's circulating around him and sort of trying to control the narrative, I suppose, a little bit. Tell us what's been happening.
Yeah, very much. This guy appears to be running out of road, to be quite honest. He fled Hong Kong, seemingly without a passport or an entry visa into Russia. He's been held up at Moscow Airport now for about a week. You're not meant to stay there more than 24 hours, as I understand it. He's clearly getting in the way of diplomatic relations between the United States and seemingly every other country in the world at this point in time. So he's going to become, I don't know, almost a leper, I feel, on the international sphere. Because, of course, the problem is, you know, he's putting himself on his own petard, and he's going to get hoisted upon it very, very quickly, I think. Because ultimately, whilst you can look at it and say, well, okay, I feel sympathy for the chap, nations are going to put national interest ahead of any one individual every single time they get the opportunity to make that decision. And I think you're seeing that being borne out. Nobody seems to want him. The Chinese were quite happy to let him go, thinking he was leaving Hong Kong. The Russians were clearly happy to make sure that he transited through Moscow Airport, but the Ecuadorians don't seem to want him. The Russians are now saying, we don't want you to spoil America's partnerships, for example. You know, when you have Putin, the ex-head of the KGB, saying that, you realise this guy is running into a world of pain, quite frankly. And he's issued this statement this morning through WikiLeaks, which again raises the spectre of where Julian Assange is in all this. And, you know, when you consider that the Ecuadorian government have backed away from this because they feel that he's being manipulated by WikiLeaks, I don't think he's doing himself any favours in the long run.
Well, he has indeed applied for political asylum in about 21 countries. Does it look likely that we'll find a future home for him? Or who's most likely to say, you know, come on in, it's okay?
Well, I understand Tehran is nice this time of the year, and maybe North Korea. You're heading towards the axis of evil, almost, which, of course, has shrunk since George W. Bush announced it with Iraq, supposedly no longer being on that list, I guess. So the list of nations that he could really head to that don't have any sort of extradition treaty with the US is becoming shorter by the day, I would suggest.
And I guess also shorter by the day is perhaps the attention span that everybody else has for Snowden and his pronouncements. So we've seen this sort of hyperlinked statement on various sort of sources this morning, originally through WikiLeaks, as you said. And people are going to it. People are interested in what this guy has to say firsthand. But I wonder, take this further down the road, is there a danger of him being Assange-ified, sort of turned into a slightly more laughable figure, something who can be potentially discredited.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. You know, let's be honest, the media has a focus upon a story which is always going to be moving, not out of any critique of the media, but because there's always a new, better, bigger story coming along. And the public will go with the agenda that's set by the media. Ultimately, Snowden's going to fall by the wayside. You know, people almost forget that, you know, Assange has been held up in the Ecuadorian embassy here in London seemingly forever. He's become a bit of a laughing stock. Snowden's ultimate naivety, I think, will be used against him by a variety of nations. And I think he will be someone who will be, you know, held in esteem, I think, by Guardian readers. But I think the wider audience will move on. And I think he'll miss a trick.
But do you also think, you know, that the media has kind of missed a point? Because the real story necessarily is not about the man himself, but it is perhaps what he's uncovered or what he's trying to release. Have we missed something here?
Well, I think it's a good question. You've fundamentally got the challenge here, which is that the story itself is important, you know, what he's trying to get out there. But let's be honest about it. You know, what do intelligence agencies do? They spy on other nations and try to get as much data as possible whilst retaining as much data as possible. That's what the NSA does. It's what GCHQ does. It's what MI6 does. It's what the KGB did. This is no new great story. It's new to people who are new to the story, potentially. But, you know, this is where I talk about Snowden's naivety coming in. He works at the NSA. My goodness, it's a spy agency. Ah, shock, horror. We're spying upon people who are our friends and our allies. Guess what, pal? They always have done. They always will do. We spy on other nations as well here out of London. So anybody who's surprised by this shouldn't be surprised.
Well, let's move outside the US, although with a connection to the US still, I suppose. The situation in Egypt has gone through quite a lot of flux in the last couple of days. So we had this military ultimatum yesterday afternoon, the army saying 48 hours to sort it out, essentially, Morsi, or else.
Yeah, and it's important to note that that came on the 1st of July. I was just talking to one of your producers earlier on. Back in April, I was advised that there would be a coup in July, led by the army, this July.
And who advised you of that?
Well, a chap working for a senior think tank out of Cairo back in April. So, which is very, very interesting. So come the 1st of July comes the announcement from the army. So this idea that this is any great surprise, again, is not that surprising. There was an awful lot of tension rising in Cairo. I have friends over there, and I said to them at the time, you know, be careful going over there because July could get a bit dicey. There's no doubt about it that the Muslim Brotherhood, I think, have disappointed a great number of their fellow countrymen. Nobody seems to know where the country's going. And I think you're seeing an attempt by the army to try and impose some degree of stability on the country, lest it fall out of control and into utter chaos, quite frankly. Nobody seems to know where the United States stands on this. Of course, you know, with its rather tepid attempt to sort of lead from behind in that part of the world, it hasn't exactly established itself in any great way, I think. So we really have to see what transpires, I think, in the next couple of days, but certainly the next 24, 36 hours, I think, will be telling. And it's no surprise either. I mean, I was laughing when I heard that Morsi was saying he'd not been consulted by the army. It's not usual that coup leaders consult with those about to be toppled. Sorry, Morsi.
And another area where the U.S. trying to reassert some of its influence, perhaps, is on the African continent as well. Obama on a trip to different parts of Africa. You can tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about whether Snowden's can become a bit of a figure of derisory nature. I worry that Obama could be heading down that route as well. The poor chap doesn't seem to be able to do anything well. You know that old saying, be careful what you wish for? He wanted a second term, he's got it. But what's he going to do with it? Bill Clinton and George W. Bush both went to Africa in their second term in office. It's not unusual. They both went for an extended period of time. Unfortunately, Barack Obama has gone relatively late. I think a lot of people might have thought he would have gone in his first term with his heritage, for example. He's gone at a time of austerity. It's been acknowledged that the trip is costing $100 million at a time when America could probably do with spending that elsewhere. And the poor chap, even when he goes to Robben Island and stands at the famous door that was supposed to have been the port of departure for slaves leading Robben Island to go for the transatlantic journey. When other presidents have done that, that's been fine. It's now been revealed supposedly that this was actually not a door to send slaves onto ships because they've suggested that the port area in front of it was too shallow for ships. It was actually where you used to get rid of waste and rubbish. So Obama has been photographed standing at the bin door, and of course with all the symbolism there for his supposed destroyed rest of his presidency.
You've got to think through the photo ops, gentlemen, advising Mr. Obama. I mean, just briefly, it seems that the sort of the headline kind of quote that's being taken out of this is Africa for Africans, or at least that's the line that the administration wants us to be thinking about. Is that a bit nebulous? Does that stand for anything really economically underpinning this?
It's hardly original, is it, quite frankly?
Well, yeah.
A lot of people are also saying it's interesting that Obama's talking about providing electricity to Africans at this point, at a time when, Phil, you'll know this, there have been electricity blackouts, and we've had all sorts of problems in California in recent years. And some people are saying, well, why don't we have electricity for Americans before we start providing it to Africans? So it's a very, very challenging time, I think, for Obama. He seems to be stumbling wherever he's going and whatever he's doing at this point.
Absolutely fantastic stuff. Dr. James Boyce from King's College London, many thanks for joining us here on the programme.
Coming up, she was Chile's first female president and left office in 2010. But Michelle Bachelet is still one of the most popular politicians in the country's political history. We'll ask why right after this.
The results are out. Monocle's seventh annual Quality of Life survey has shuffled the deck and ranks the cities we think are most livable in 2013. And the winner is Copenhagen.
This is a population and a city that's become markedly more extrovert in recent years. There's more life on the streets than ever before, and its people are not only more engaged locally, but also eager to show Copenhagen off to the rest of the world. Copenhageners have hit a high point of pride in their city, and it shows.
Copenhagen, our film about the best city to call home. On Monocle.com.
Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this is, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
Welcome back to the show. Now, over the weekend, Chileans chose which candidate will be on the ballot for presidential elections later in the year. This was the first time the country held primary elections. On the left side, there's former President Michelle Bachelet. She got 73% of the vote, while the right wing was somewhat split. Former Economy Minister Pablo Longueira managed to beat former Defence Minister Andrés Alamand, albeit by a slim margin. A connection with Pinochet might make Longueira unelectable, though, and Michelle Bachelet currently enjoys high approval ratings amongst Chileans.
Well, a little earlier, Monocle's Fernando Agosto Pacheco spoke to our Santiago correspondent Steve Bodzin on why the former leader is still, at least for the moment, the only runner in the race.
This is the first time that Chile's government has been in charge of the primaries. It's pretty much a two-party system here, but those two major groupings are actually broken down into a whole bunch of smaller parties, and these different parties get together and have kind of group primaries. So on the left, there's something called the Concertación, which this year went by the term the New Majority, and that's a group of several parties this year. Four different parties participated, and on the right, two parties participated, and now each one is down to one candidate each. We've got Michelle Bachelet on the left, former president, very popular, and on the right, Pablo Longueira, a recently retired economy minister and longtime kind of right-wing politician and senator and assistant to various presidents and right-wing leaders.
But I have to ask you, was it a wise decision to choose Longueira? Because I know he had some connections with Pinochet as well. Do you think this will do well with the voters in Chile?
It's a good question. He got his start under the dictator Augusto Pinochet, as you said. And this is a long time ago by some of our standards, but at the same time, it's certainly present in the Chilean memory. It's going to be his big negative point. People are going to remind him of that during the campaign, no question about it. Already you see cartoons in the kind of left-leaning papers mocking him for his past with Pinochet. At the same time, I think the younger voters and those who have any sympathy at all for conservative beliefs are willing to look past that, because he was in the last years of Pinochet. He was involved, and that was when the dictator was certainly more moderate than he had started out. Also, Longuera has more recently redeemed himself in many ways by being a real voice for small business, for the kind of struggling entrepreneur who might be kind of up and coming and maybe not exactly poor, but certainly fighting against the entrenched big business interests that still largely run Chile.
And how do Chileans view the current president, Sebastián Piñera? I mean, we have to tell people that actually you can't be reelected in Chile. That's why Bachelet was not reelected in 2006 as well. But how do they view Piñera?
Well, Piñera has had a real roller coaster of a presidency. He came into office with a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of hope, because basically, for people who don't know Chilean history, what happened is the dictatorship ended in 1990. We had 20 years of essentially left-wing governments who largely kept the same old policies. They brought in some changes. There was certainly more freedom in Chile, but people were very tired after 20 years of not having seen the level of change, the amount of shared prosperity that they were hoping for with the end of the dictatorship 20 years earlier. So they brought in Piñera with all this hope. He pretty quickly had this situation with the 33 miners up in the desert where they had a spectacular success of rescuing these 33 guys from deep underground. But then things just went straight downhill, and he went from having high approval ratings to having the lowest imaginable, 20% approval ratings, that level. And these days, he's come back somewhat with the elections approaching. They've been spending more government money, giving out bonuses just for example, giving out bonuses to any couple that's been married for 50 years, giving out bonuses to, proposing bonuses for any mother who has three children or more. So these kind of very populist moves that are just traditional Latin American election vote getting type of behavior. So yeah, his approval's been coming back some, but no, Piñera is widely disliked. There's almost no question that the right is going to lose the next election, because Piñera has really not been the answer people are looking for. He's brought in some very good policies, in my opinion, and certainly some policies that I think in the long term will be looked back on as successful. But he as a person has had a very low approval rating. People have not been impressed with his ability to connect with the public. And he's provoked the biggest movements in this country in decades, as students have taken to the streets pretty much constantly for the last 2 years to demand free public education and other social changes.
But at the same time, former President Bachelet is the clear favorite to win this election. Do you think there's even a risk that she might not get the presidency again?
There's always a risk, right? You never know what happens in an election. And it would be probably an insult to all the other candidates, both Longuera and all of the various more independent candidates, to say that Bachelet is absolutely a shoo-in. You never know. But yeah, yesterday was with the primaries, she had a pretty impressive showing. Of 3 million votes cast in the primary, she got more than 1.5 million votes. So remember, this is a primary that's broken down into the right-wing side and the left-wing side. So she got so many votes just from the left-wing side that she actually got not only a majority of the votes among the four candidates on her side, but also a majority, even including the two candidates on the right-wing side. I mean, she just demolished all other comers. So it is going to be a real uphill fight for any of the kind of independent candidates to take her on, or for Longuera to beat her. The one thing that I think people are really looking for, rather than trying to beat her, is to take her to a second round. If anybody can get her below 50% in the first round of voting in November, they get to go to a second round with her and become kind of whoever takes her to a second round becomes a more important personality in the political scene in the years ahead.
But Bachelet, I have to say that she's also quite respected in the international scene politically. Do Chileans know that? Do they know that she's quite a very, very important figure for Chile, no?
Sure, yes. I think people absolutely have a lot of respect for her. I mean, there's no question that even though there's a lot of bad taste in people's mouths over a few specific aspects of her presidency, mostly that she did not succeed in bringing in free public education for universities and or repairing the really poor public education at the primary level. She also had a disastrous last few months with the earthquake that struck in 2010, when she was already a lame duck president, and she did a very bad emergency management job with the earthquake. People seem willing to forgive that. And part of that is exactly that she made them proud as Chileans. She did elevate Chile's stature at the international level. And in the years since, she went and worked for the UN. She kept a pretty low profile domestically. But yes, she went around the world and has managed to avoid any missteps, certainly as an ex-president.
That was Monocle Santiago correspondent Steve Bodzin speaking to Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And it is 25 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. Now, Da Vinci's Last Supper, Michelangelo's David, as we speak here in London, queues are likely forming in Italy to catch a glimpse of two of the world's most revered pieces of art. But they nearly weren't there at all. Both were part of a group of more than 5,000 works of art rescued, protected, or found by two very unlikely American heroes who embarked on quite an adventure towards the end of the Second World War.
These mountainous impasses were once traversed by the Romans. Now U.S. troops, conditioned for this terrain, ever cautious of their footing, plod their way up...
So that's the U.S. heading towards Florence, we think. And after the end of hostilities in Italy in 1944, the U.S. administration put together a team to try and protect Italy's most valuable cultural artifacts. Italy and its art had been seized by Germany the year before, and attempts were underway to try and smuggle as much as possible back into the Reich. Well, the story's told in a new book by Robert M. Edsel. It's called Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. I'm pleased to say Robert joins us now in the studio. Welcome to the programme, Robert.
Thank you very much.
Perhaps you could start by explaining, this is your third foray into this subject. Why the passion for this particular subject? What was your introduction to it?
It's an epic story about, you imagine all the museums in Europe closed for a matter of 5 to 6 years during World War II, millions of works of art on bomb-cratered roads being moved around to try and get them out of the cities and protect them from bombing and the effects of war. And of course, then comes the greatest theft in history, the premeditated looting by Adolf Hitler and the Nazis of so many great museums and private collections in Northern Europe. And similar events took place in Italy. I was living in Italy in 1996 and was crossing the Ponte Vecchio Bridge one day, the only bridge not destroyed by the Nazis when they fled the city in August 1944. And I wondered how, in the face of the most destructive conflict in history, the loss of 65 million lives, did so many of these great works of art survive, and who were the people that saved them? And no one seemed to know the answer, which fascinated me because we all know a fair bit about World War II history. And yet here's this epic story that's been, in a way, hidden right in front of us. And it led me to the discovery of these men and women known as Monuments Men, about 70% American and 30% British, a remarkable period when the American and British leaders helped preserve so much of the cultural treasures of Western civilization.
And obviously you focus much of the book on Nazi Germany's role in this, but of course the Allied bombing raids in Italy also had an impact, and the first chapter of the book actually opens on some of those bombing raids in Milan.
You're right, and it's a dramatic way to tell the story because it's a dramatic event. A bomb lands, an Allied bomb lands about 80 feet away from Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper, which is housed in a building called the Refectory, a dining hall, a long rectangular building. The painting's on the north wall. The blast of this bomb, in an effort to try and force Italy out of the war to switch sides, the blast of the bomb obliterates a courtyard nearby. It blows out the east wall of the building. Without an east wall, the roof collapses, and the painting's exposed to the elements, and only as a result of the local artificials putting scaffolding in place to support the wall on the what if this could happen, did the painting even survive.
You've written a lot about this subject, as we said. You must have thought a lot then about how we value culture, how we value art, and within within a sort of circumstance of total war as we had then, where the human life is the sort of currency that we're thinking about. Give us your thoughts on how then the idea of the value of art, of culture, comes into play.
It's a great question. You know, one of the, I suppose, subplots in all of the books in the telling of this, my last book, The Monuments Men, which tells the story of the monuments officers in Northern Europe, two of whom were killed during combat. And so it raises this question, is art worth a life? And I certainly think art is as a life's worth a cause, and the cause of saving art, I think, is like the fighting for democracy, fighting for the right to be free, because these are our connections to our history. And during World War II, these men and women that were American and British, that were scholars, museum directors, art curators, artists themselves, that walked away from established lives and their families to volunteer for military service to try and save these things, really played a heroic role in so many of them surviving. And it's been a great honor to tell their story.
So then, just building on that point, how upsetting is it then for you personally to see, you know, this of course happened back in World War II, but look at the situation, that's what happened during the Iraq War, what's happening now in the ancient cities of Syria, and seeing thousand-year-old pieces of art just being demolished.
Well, in Aleppo and Apamea in Syria, it's very distressing for all of us, and it's not one side or the other. Both sides are doing this a lot of times to draw media attention, to help get money for their causes. You know, it's a very depressing thing for me when I was living in Europe in 2003 as an American to watch the criticism my country underwent for their American-led invasion of Iraq and the complete failure, despicable failure, to plan to protect the cultural treasures. And it's not just the National Museum of Iraq, but their National Archives, National Library, which were very severely damaged. And there was not the planning. So, you know, when you consider during a world war, the loss of 65 million people and a handful of men and women, handful, no more than 40 in Italy by the end of the war, no more than 120 or so in Northern Europe, with no technology, many of them hitchhiking around, were able to have such a effective performance. We see the pain and the consequences of not planning for this in advance. So that's a big part of all this work, and why I think this film George Clooney's making, based on my last book, which will be called The Monuments Men, is so critical. I mean, hopefully there'll be a film made of saving Italy, but it's so critical because it reaches, you know, hundreds of millions of people around the world to tell the story.
Robert M. Edsel is author of Saving Italy, The Race to Rescue a Nation's Treasures from the Nazis. And if, like George Clooney, you want to have a read, how can you do it? Where can we pick this book up?
This book will be in every bookstore, bookseller in England, of course, online sellers. So it's going to be widely available, and I hope people get out and get it. There's a great photo of the David with rubble at the base of it after it had been removed from its brick-entombed protective device. And so you can't miss it in a store.
That's good. That's like the radio equivalent of when you hold up the book cover for
there
the camera,
go.
Isn't it?
Well there
done on that. Robert, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Toronto
to Amsterdam
to Zurich,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And in the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be checking in with our correspondent in Stockholm. We'll leaf through this morning's Italian front pages, and we'll be heading to Beirut for its annual Design Week festivities.
In terms of product design and furniture design, most of the Lebanese people, they just import their furniture from famous designers abroad. Then again, there are a handful of designers. You don't really have a lot of choices.
But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. WikiLeaks says the US surveillance whistleblower Edward Snowden has applied to 21 countries for asylum, including Ecuador, Norway and Russia. WikiLeaks has released a statement from Snowden in which he accuses the Obama administration of denying him his right to seek asylum. The European Union says it expects a full explanation from the United States on the allegations that it's been spying on its allies. President Obama has dismissed the row, saying if he wants to know what the leaders of France, Germany or Britain are thinking, he calls them. Egypt's official news agency says the country's foreign minister, Mohamed Kamel Ahmed, has tendered his resignation. At least five other ministers have resigned in the wake of the protests against Mohamed Morsi's government. The Taliban says it carried out an attack which killed six people at a foreign logistics company in the Afghan capital, Kabul. Two lorry drivers and four guards were killed after a suicide bomber drove a truck loaded with explosives into a vehicle bay in a compound near Kabul airport. At least two attackers were then killed in a brief gunfight. Israel has launched a crackdown against Jewish ultranationalists in the West Bank. They're accused of deliberately vandalizing Palestinian property to try to worsen sectarian tensions. An unmanned Russian rocket has crashed seconds after blasting off from a cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. The Proton M rocket was carrying three satellites for Russia's global navigation system. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds, and this man, Phil Hahn.
Thank you very much. In this week's episode of Section D, we'll be heading over to one of the world's most exciting architecture schools to peek in on the building planners and city designers of the future. We then focus on the UK's capital as we head over to London Festival of Architecture. And we'll also head to Florida for a tour of design Mark Diamond's studios there. But in this week's preview, we're heading to Lebanon and to Beirut and to the Beirut Design Week.
Indeed. Build as a chance for the country's design industry to come together and show a different side of an embattled country. The event has been heralded as a great success, but how vibrant is the design scene in a country currently under the shadow of the civil war in neighbouring Syria and long blighted by its own fractious politics and even shakier infrastructure? Well, Monocle contributor Ed Woodhouse hit the streets of the Lebanese capital on our behalf to find out.
One of the most common questions expats living in Beirut get asked is, do all the women there wear burqas? It's a question that will provoke a grin from most of those to whom it's put, because the truth is just about the exact opposite. Beirutis take the notion that life is a catwalk to a whole new level. Their devotion to style and fashion puts Paris to shame. And their eye for design is in evidence everywhere you look, from the city's chicly appointed bars to its many dizzyingly expensive furniture shops. It's clear that these are a people for whom style is central. But what of the local design culture? Is all this imported taste, or are there people on the ground setting the design agenda for the city? The fact that the city's second annual Beirut Design Week has seen people flying in from all over the world to take part hints at the answer. Design Week's co-founder, Doreen Tutikan, explains why they felt Beiruti design needed celebrating.
Well, we were just thinking that Beirut Design Week is something that we finally need to have in this city. There's so much design happening, so much creative talent. All over the world you hear about Lebanese designers going around in fashion and products and graphics and doing amazing things. And there really wasn't a platform to really showcase that in the country. So we thought, you know, 2012 was the first time to do it. And now 2013 is the second one and it's getting bigger and better.
The idea that there is an industry generating both money and good news stories for Lebanon, whilst being wholly unappreciated by an obstructive government, is a theme that comes up in almost every conversation you have about Lebanese design.
I mean, this is our story. People in Lebanon, the individuals, try to do something with their lives, and basically the government doesn't help them. This is the story. We're always trying to do our best, and our politicians are trying to do their worst. Basically, if you want to summarize it, this is it.
Jewelry designer Nada Zeina took a break from the buzzing rooftop launch party for her latest collection of exquisitely handcrafted gold jewelry to explain why there is such a disproportionate number of successful designers here, despite the fact that it's a small city which often lives under such trying circumstances.
I think that Lebanese people have learned that they can only count on themselves. They cannot expect anything from anybody. So basically, you cannot really be just employee, because you will not go very far. And so you can design. They are exposed to so many civilizations because of the war, they had to travel a lot. So they've seen a lot. And they've heard of it. I mean, they really have been exposed to many things. So it's normal that they will try to do something on their own. And this is why you have that many people doing nice things. We're confronted to ugly things, to what I call in French obscurantisme. It's like darkness. It's the dark side of a human being. So this is very hard because this is our resistance. It's a daily resistance to keep on doing something interesting, to not let go to hatred and bad feelings, we have no other solution but to try harder. But sometimes, believe me, sometimes I just feel like, oh my God, that's it, I stop. But I don't stop. This is the proof you see today. I have a lot of people, I have a new collection, a lot of people are coming. We really live day by day.
It's a compelling idea that Beirut is so drawn to beauty and has such a vibrant design industry because it counterbalances the ugliness so often present in the country's politics and sectarian divides. But most importantly, Nada's work is bought all over the world, and like the majority of successful Beiruti designers, it's this that gives her her success. The vitality that the Beirut design industry enjoys comes from the recognition it has won outside the country. But what about those aforementioned glamorous domestic buyers? Are they supporting the industry? And if not, what does this mean for the future of Lebanese design? Ghassan Salameh is a product designer who focuses on furniture and lighting. His Design Week exhibition included a staggeringly inventive mechanical inset-like standing lamp, and it has seen him recognized as one of the great talents uncovered by the event. So what does someone up-and-coming think of the Beirut design industry?
In terms of product design and furniture design, most of the Lebanese people, they just, like the rich people who actually can pay to get their furniture, they import their furniture from famous designers abroad. Few of them, they get from the Lebanese designers, but then again, there are a handful of designers, you know, you can count them. They are very known, and at some point it becomes a little bit limited because you don't really have a lot of choices. I mean, you have a lot of Lebanese designers, architects who are extremely successful abroad. When I was in Europe, I toured a lot of cities, I went to a lot of museums, and I started discovering Lebanese artists being exposed in museums in Europe, in major museums in Europe that I haven't even heard of in Lebanon. You know, and you can tell like how much Lebanese people can be successful abroad, but they cannot be here. And then you come here and you see that your government kind of works against you by bringing foreign architects or foreign designers to contract major projects when you have the actual talent here and you have the possibility to work with people here.
The night before Design Week started, the country was again pushed closer to all-out sectarian violence, with the army battling followers of a hardline Sunni cleric. The interviews in this piece were conducted at glamorous parties, while a few dozen kilometers away, there was open warfare on the streets of Lebanon's third city, Sidon. Lebanon's design industry is built on dichotomies just like this. It is successful globally, despite being for the large part overlooked at home. Design Week was such a huge hit that it's given the industry its proudest moment so far, yet at the same time, the host nation is wandering back into chaos. And this is the great irony of the Lebanese design industry. It contains a huge amount of talented and successful people who are constantly striving to perfect form, while the country around it fails to function. For Monocle, in Beirut, this is Ed Woodhouse.
Thank you very much, Ed. He was reporting from the second annual Beirut Design Week, and you can hear Ed's report and many more from the world of international design in the latest edition of Section D. That's tonight at 1900 hours London time.
But right now, you, of course, are listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. In a moment, we'll be back with a daily check-in with one of our correspondents from around the world. Today, we'll be heading to Sweden. That's all coming up.
With a nod to the past and a wink to the future, Monocle takes a look at the world of perfume and the new generation of expert alchemists.
One of the things that becomes quite an achievement in fragrance is creating that intangible magic when three or four or five disparate elements come together. And in that sense, it's not dissimilar to the visual arts, to painting, or to music.
Artisan Perfume Makers, a film from London, New York, and Buenos Aires on Monocle.com.
And you are listening to Midori House, where the time here in London is 8:44.
It certainly is. And that is time to go to Stockholm today. Our correspondent there is Elna Nikkanen Anderson, and she joins us on the line now. Elna, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm excellent. Phil is slightly less good.
I'm well. I'm doing well.
You bearing up?
I'm doing well. I had a slight cold, but I'm pushing through.
Okay. Phil's had a rebrand since the beginning of the show,
and
he's now fine. Elna, let's talk about politics, which is what lots of people are going to be talking about this week, I believe. What exactly is Alma Dahlin?
Alma Dahlin is a week of politics in Sweden on the island of Gotland, which is normally just a pleasant island for holidays. But this week, once every year, it's completely invaded by politicians and lobbyists and PR people. And it seems like the whole country is just filled with political news and moves.
So what's the main purpose of this gathering? Is it to hash out policy or to brainstorm on kind of the future of the country? What's the main reason behind it?
Well, it started as a kind of a small gathering of people, but it's been growing and growing, and it seems like parties are using it as a way of positioning themselves and as a way of raising their profile. And each day is kind of dedicated to one party, and they get to talk about their issues and their proposals and so on. And so it's got a huge media coverage, and it's a big chance for all parties to raise their profile.
I suppose with potential profile raising up for grabs and all of the media coverage that it attracts, presumably there are accusations that the lobbyists and the PR people are more significant than any kind of policy or communicating with voters. How does the ordinary Swede feel about this sort of thing?
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes these sort of PR tricks have taken over. One year there was a feminist party leader that burnt up 100,000 kroner just to get to highlight that that women earn less money than men. And sometimes it's like it's just about the show and the scandal. But there are more and more serious issues coming up. For instance, yesterday also Pussy Riot was there, the Russian artist group, and there are some new laws being discussed and so on. So it's a serious event as well.
And Elna, moving on to another story that's grabbed the headlines. A new law has come into effect on Monday. It's the ban against secret photography of people in the home or in public places.
Yeah, that's another news that's been discussed quite a lot. And basically the purpose is to protect private people from being photographed secretly, for instance, in changing rooms or toilets and so on. But because there's been some cases where, for instance, young girls have been photographed and then the pictures have ended up in the internet or in media or somewhere. And this law is trying to come to get at that. But it's been criticized by professional journalists because they're worried that it might affect journalistic work.
Well, presumably that would have a sort of chilling effect on freedom of expression, they would be arguing at this point.
Exactly, and they're saying that it should be a publishing decision and not a photographer's decision. And that's where the decision should be made, whether something should be published or not, which does sound reasonable.
So this law is...
But there, it has to be said that there is an exception for journalistic work in the law. But it's not always so clear-cut what is journalistic and what is not. So there's going to be difficulties in interpretation, I believe.
Absolutely. And this law has only come into effect yesterday. How do we think this is going to be policed, and what kind of sentences or penalties will be placed on people who are convicted of it?
Yeah, we haven't seen any cases yet, of course, since it's so new. But it's quite a tough, the maximum sentence would be 2 years in prison. So it's quite a tough law. But also there could be just fines. So we'll just have to see how it works in practice.
Elna, let's briefly talk about Stockholmers and their methods of transport, at least the ones they prefer. And two wheels are better than four, it seems.
Yes, exactly. I mean, of course, it's summer here now, as everywhere else, but Stockholmers have started to use their bikes more and more, finally, because at the moment it's still just 10% of residents here that take their bikes to work. In Copenhagen, it's 40%, but it's growing, and now it's on a record levels. the city is trying to do more to improve the bike routes, for instance. So hopefully we'll get to bike even more in the future.
Excellent stuff. Elna Nykänen-Andersson, Monocle's correspondent in Stockholm, many thanks for joining us on the program this morning.
Up next, we'll be leafing through the Italian front pages with Monocle's own Italian David Pleasant. But to lead us there, here's Brunori Sas with Come Stai. Di come navigare al rallentatore. Forse dentro me cambiano. Come stai? That is by Brunori Sas.
Dominic, your Italian just keeps getting better and better.
It does, particularly when it's written out in front of me. I tend to be quite good at saying Italian words.
I'm very
words.
Impressed.
Thank you very much.
Very impressed. Well, you are indeed listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. It's time now for us to leaf through this morning's Italian front pages with the very lovely Monocle's David Pleasant. Hello, David. How are you?
Hello, Phil. I'm very well, thanks.
Nice to see you. Let's start with the Corriere della Sera, shall we?
Yes. So the Pope, another one of his kind of surprise announcements, he keeps catching the Italian and the international press unawares. This time he's announced that in an unofficial capacity, he's going to visit the illegal migrants who are stuck on the Lampedusa island south of Sicily. As many people may have read in the papers over the years, frequently migrants get caught up in trying to kind of there's quite often rather tragic, very tragic drownings of migrants. And the Pope said he was particularly touched by a recent tragedy where several hundred migrants were caught on tuna fishing nets. So he's going there on a whistle stop tour of the island to meet the migrants and to pray with them.
I see. And I presume we should be reading this in terms of new Pope sending out messaging to the world about what type of Pope he's going to be. We heard in the hours after his arrival that he would be someone who looks to the poor. And clearly that sort of message still being knocked out, it seems.
Exactly. He's going for that kind of campaign. Although I think he's trying to do everything differently. He keeps saying this is in an unofficial capacity. I'm not going as Pope, but obviously that just doesn't bide when
so
you are
just going to turn up in exactly. a t-shirt and jeans.
Exactly. But even the Curia, the kind of government or structure around him, say that they weren't aware of this. It's unplanned. Some people within the Catholic Church are slightly concerned, you know, this unorthodox way of doing things. He also there's a YouTube video of him around at the moment giving an impromptu exorcism to a visiting child in the Vatican. Quite controversial actions from the Pope.
An impromptu exorcism. I would have, if I was doing an exorcism, I'd definitely prepare.
Yeah, exactly. I would hope so, Dom.
Yeah, I always prepare my exorcisms. Let's move on to a topic that we have discussed one angle of today. This is Edward Snowden and the latest revelations. But let's hear what the view from Italy is on this.
Yeah, there's more and more revelations. La Repubblica has devoted a good five or six of its front pages to the revelations. The main source of intrigue is the fact that the Italian embassy in Washington was heavily spied upon, according to the revelations, with micro spies and so on. Another interesting take is that there are claims that Anglo-Saxon allies of Washington, i.e. Great Britain, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, were spied upon much less than their non-Anglo-Saxon counterparts, i.e. France, Italy, Germany. These allegations or this kind of view is being backed by Hollande as well, François Hollande, President of France, who says that France cannot accept this type of way of doing things and has called for an immediate ceasing to these activities by America. Similarly, the President of Italy, Giorgio Giorgio Napolitano has said that he's dismayed by the actions by a so-called ally. And similarly, the defense minister and the minister of interior has said that the relations between America and Italy have been severely compromised.
Interesting stuff. Well, the one story, though, that we really want to talk about here on Midori House your next story. What can you tell us about this? I hear there's a great conference going on. Dominic, are you heading? I hear you might be going as well.
Conference of growing size is happening. Tell us what's going on.
There is a conference. It's called the Wonderful Life Conference, which is held at the hotel called Base or Base outside of Venice.
So the Wonderful Life Conference is presumably people gathering together to watch Frank Capra movies and family fun, right?
I'm afraid it's not quite innocent. It's it happens to be the International Swingers Conference for the region, the Veneto region, and this has caused a bit of dismay from the local residents. It's a small town of Noventa di Piave, a small town of 6,000 people in quite a conservative area of Italy. The residents have been calling for the activities of this annual conference to cease, and it's bringing the wrong kind of attention to their town. The local hoteliers association have defended the hotel, saying that they are all consenting adults and he sees no moral issue whatsoever, and we should be opening up our doors, especially in the times of crisis.
I suspect a lot of those hotel doors will be opening up over this weekend by the sounds of things.
Exactly.
Well, it's moving back and forth along the creepy collies of the hallways of those hotels, perhaps.
Let's wish them well.
Indeed. Good luck, everybody, at the Swingers Conference.
David Pleasant, many thanks for having a flick through this morning's Italian Front Pages.
And that is all we have time for today's Midori House. Thank you to our producer, Thomas Lewis, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Tess McCann was one of the researchers too, and Mr. Chris Fitch was the studio manager.
Up next after the news is The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove, and both Dominic and myself will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.
Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.